Welcome to the Fremantle Press Podcast. My name's Rebecca Hickey, and today's episode is all about historical fiction. We're joined by Elaine Forrestal to discuss her new middle grade historical novel, Goldfields Girl, and Diane Wolfer to talk about her successful trilogy of picture books for middle grade readers, Lighthouse Girl, Light Horse Boy, and In the Lamplight. Settle in as we explore the harsh realities of gold fever during colonial times and the effects of war on young people during the early part of the 20th century. You may want to take notes as we discuss how to write a good historical fiction. Elaine Forrestal is a full-time writer who lives and works in Scarborough, Western Australia. She grew up in the Wheat Belt but now travels all over the world and has spoken at festivals and presented writing workshops in Australia, Singapore, France, Italy, and Ireland. Her novel, Someone Like Me, won the CBCA Book of the Year Award, and three titles in her Eden Glassy mystery series are recommended for the Geography Syllabus Stage 3 or the National Curriculum. Elaine, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Rebecca?
I'm good. Now, let's start with your new book. Can you tell us a bit about Goldfields Girl?
Well, it's obviously set in the goldfields, but in the very early days of the Yilgarn, which is in the Yilgarn area of Western Australia, which is desert country. And most people in Western Australia weren't, well, most Europeans, people of European origin, weren't used to that much desert. They weren't used to the lack of water and the lack of food even. They were used to being able to go out and, you know, catch their rabbits or kill their kangaroos or whatever and eat them. And, of course, that far out, they're very scarce and not really enough to sustain them. So that was a big problem. But one that Clara, my main character, wasn't really aware of, and I mean, a lot of people weren't, but she wasn't aware of it because she'd grown up on the East Coast where streams are plentiful, there's always water around somewhere close by, and wildlife is much more plentiful too than in our eastern deserts. So she set off to have a big adventure, and as you do, she encountered lots of danger, much more excitement than she was bargaining on, and a lot of challenge, lots of challenges. I don't want to say too much about it because I want people to read about her, but yes, it is an adventure story, a love story, and as well as being historically accurate.
Wonderful. I think that's a great summary without giving too much away, without giving any spoilers. Now, our next guest is Diane Wolfer. Diane is the acclaimed author of many books for teenagers and young readers. Her book, Lighthouse Girl, served as inspiration for Piaf's The Giants and features in events commemorating the centenary of the departure of the first AIF from Albany. One of Diane's picture books, Photographs in the Mud, Set Along the Kokoda Track, is used as an international peace reference and has been published in Japanese. Diane, welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be speaking with you and Elaine.
Now, I believe you're on the phone from Albany, where your Light series all began. Can you describe that series for us?
Yes, the Light series actually didn't start as a series. The first book, Lighthouse Girl, was an idea way back in 2005. I was reading Dr. Forensic Day, I was reading the paper and saw an article by Ron Crittle, and it was mentioning a girl signalling to the huge convoy that left Albany. And I thought, oh, that's unusual. I didn't know anything about it. No one really knew much about it then. So that evocative idea and the image of the girl out on Breakfast stayed with me. So I tried to shape it into a picture book, which was way too many words. But luckily, amazing team at Fremantle Press, especially Kate Sutherland, saw something in it that and decided to try something different. So that's how Lighthouse Girl came about. But it was the research through that I found out, I became really interested in the ship journey from Albany to Egypt and all the things that the soldiers and nurses got up to, just the, you know, pranks, and it was also different for them. But then I found out about the horses and the animal mascots that accompanied them, and I was just really hooked and wanted to find out more about that, particularly Sandy, the one horse, the one Australian horse that returned. So that turned into Light Horse Boy, and then there was certainly no intention of a third. But I was visiting a little village of Harefield, north of London, in 2011 for another story idea. And I learnt that Harefield was home to an Australian hospital during World War One, and that each Anzac Day villagers marched down to the cemetery and lay flowers. Then I saw a picture of a wallaby mascot that had been at the Harefield, and all of those things came together and I realised there had to be a bird. So it wasn't intentional.
Wonderful. That's, again, another wonderful description. And before we get more into, I want to ask all of you about your research and your inspiration and so on. But let's start with what's becoming a staple of this podcast. We're recording via phone in once again due to the coronavirus pandemic. So I'd like to start by asking how the virus has affected you and how you work. Elaine, let's start with you.
Well, on the surface, it hasn't changed my day-to-day life very much because I've worked from home for 20-odd years now. So that's really, I mean, I hate being so isolated from my friends and things, but the fact of work hasn't changed a lot. But the thing that has changed, of course, is my income, because so many of the arts institutions where I speak or present workshops or do all sorts of paid jobs, they've disappeared. Well, they've closed down, and my income has certainly shrunk.
Diane, have you had a similar experience? How's the virus affecting you?
I think, yeah, there are some parallels with Elaine, in that the actual work, my daily work in the office at home is business as usual. On a personal front, we sadly lost a beloved elderly aunt in Germany to COVID, and that was
horrible. Awful. I'm so sorry.
And the same week my stepdad passed, so I couldn't get to his funeral in New South Wales. So, you know, personally, there's been a couple of really big things for me. But as far as the work front, working at home, I love to do that. However, like Elaine, for me, the timing was reasonably lucky. I just finished part of the Talented Young Writers program with the Literature Centre just before the lockdown. And the last session, there should have been 70 students, and we had 7, and everyone was really worried. And since then, I've had other presentations, either mostly delayed, they're not cancelling, but postponed, and look, who knows if they'll even go ahead till next year. They probably won't. But I think the other area that's been massive change for me is the technology. Oh, my goodness. It's, you know, I guess I've totally, because so much is happening from home, I've updated all the teaching resources on my website and linked my second website and did a Anzac clip for Fremantle Press, and so got my clips in, organised into a YouTube channel. But Writing WA have had some sessions led by Simon Pittock about, you know, I didn't know what Zoom, Teams meeting, YouTube, WebEx, Google Hangout, I didn't know any of that stuff. It's a really steep learning curve for me. However, I do think that the way things, I don't think this will be over in a hurry, and I think these are really good skills for me to be learning. So I'm really trying to upskill in those areas as much as I can.
I've been trying to set up online kind of social media accounts and getting myself out there, which is, for someone who's introverted, is quite awkward.
I know what you're saying.
But, yeah, it's probably good for me to be doing those things. But so we've discussed the virus. Let's move on to these fantastic books. Both of you write about real young girls from Western Australia. This is historical fiction we're talking about here. So, Diane, I'd love to hear about your character Faye from Lighthouse Girl. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, sure. Faye had, for the time, a very ordinary, well, I guess not so ordinary, but which I sometimes think if she knew what had happened since, it would be amazing for her. She was born in 1899 at the Cape Blouin Lighthouse, the youngest of four kids. And when she was 6, her family moved to Breaksea Island off Albany, pretty remote. Her siblings went to school over on the mainland, but she stayed out there with her mum and learnt to read, write, cook, sew, all those things. But then when World War One was declared, Albany was the gathering point for this huge, massive first AAF convoy of 36 troop ships with 30,000 men and horses, nurses. And they gathered in Albany, and so she was out there on the island, just her. Her mum had died earlier that year. Her big sister had died the year before, so it was just Faye and two lighthouse keepers, one for Dad. So she was really had a, I guess, such a basic life, but then suddenly she was in the right spot to see this incredible moment in history with all these ships gathering, which would have been, you know, miles across, and she was waving, signaling to the character, to the soldiers as they left, and was therefore the last person, last human contact. And she relayed messages back to their loved ones by the Morse code, and they then, before they went into battle, sent postcards back to her. So, she's just, I guess, an ordinary girl, but was in an extraordinary place in 1914 when those troop ships left.
Yeah, an extraordinary witness, it sounds like.
Exactly. And sometimes I think with all the things that have happened since, that if she'd known that her life has been celebrated in so many ways on stage, and it would have been amazing for her. But I think what appeals to me is that she was just an ordinary girl, but in an extraordinary place. Her life is very hard. She had to cook and clean for the lighthouse keepers, and she was good with a rifle, so she went out and shot mutton birds and rabbits when the supply boat didn't come across, which was quite often. And sometimes when the mist came down, often in winter, you can't even see breaks the island. So she was really isolated out there as just a young girl growing up at that time.
Wow. Clara in Goldfield's Girl, it also... you know, you could say she's an ordinary girl living in an extraordinary time. Elaine, can you tell us a bit more about Clara?
Sure, yes. Well, Clara as a person was always, always adventurous and funny and lively. And she grew up in a big family, and she was one of the younger ones, but she and her younger sister and her mother came across to Western Australia on a steamer, 6 weeks on a steamer around to Fremantle to help out her older sister who was living in Southern Cross. So she was right out of her not comfort zone really, because she had a mother and a sister there, but she was a long way from home. Her father and her two brothers stayed behind in Queensland to work to make the money to keep the family going. And Clara, when the job came up, well, it was an amazing time as well. So Arthur Bailey had just discovered gold way out in the desert, and he brought it into Southern Cross and displayed it in the bank, which is just a little tin shed. And Clara wondered why everyone was rushing into the bank any spare minute they had. And she went in her lunch hour, because she was working for the publican, the very first publican who'd set up a pub and in a bush shed. But there were 2,000 men already within a week of Arthur Bailey displaying this gold. So she agreed to go out to the new field from Southern Cross, a journey of 168 miles, and took 3 days in a bush cart, in a buckboard buggy, as they were called. And she and the publican's housekeeper were the only two females in amongst these 2,000 rough and rowdy prospectors. So it was a challenge for her, but she loved the challenge, and so she really made her mark there. She was a big girl, tall for her age and strong. She'd always had to help with the chores on the in Queensland and all down on the gold fields in the East Coast. She'd always had to, all of the kids, all six kids had to pitch in and build huts before they could get rid of their tent that they would live in first. And so she was very versatile, very practical, and had a lot of survival skills that she didn't know she had already. So, yeah, she She was quite remarkable, although for her time, perhaps not so remarkable. We would really find her remarkable now because the times are so different.
Well, I certainly think she's remarkable. both of these girls are very, strong characters. So, and you feature strong characters in your books. Is this a deliberate act picking strong female characters, or are you just simply drawn to these characters regardless of gender? Elaine, I'll start with you with this one.
Well, it's an interesting question because of my 18 titles that I've had published so far, the majority of them have strong male protagonists. But the balance is sort of swinging back the other way now because my last two historical fictions have had very strong female characters. So I guess it's the story as much as the character. It doesn't really matter to me whether it's a male or a female, but it's a case of whether the story seems to stick with me. I heard Diane say earlier that, the story of Faye stuck with her, and that's what happens to me. If a story sort of comes along and doesn't stay with me for a period of time, then I forget it and I let it go. But the ones that I develop are not so much because of the gender of the character, but more to do with it being an unusual story, it being a West Australian story. I mean, that's not exclusively how I work, but most of my stories are strong West Australian characters. So, it's a case of the story has to stay with me, and it has to be a story that's not particularly well known. Same with Faye.
I like that idea of the story has just captured you, because I know I get that, right. Where I just can't let go of something. I'm really entranced by a story, historical period or event or something. So I do like that. Diane, what about you?
Yeah, I'm the same as both of you. I think it's I think Elaine and I are drawn. I think we are similar writers. We're drawn to similar stories, but it's that story tingle. You know, you're reading, you're researching something, and so often stories. So many of my books, it comes out of research for something else. So I've been researching another, part of a book or part of a manuscript, and then I'll find something else, and you just don't know what you're going to find. So I didn't sort of think, oh, I need to have a strong female character. I just was drawn to the image of Faye, and when I walked my dog on the beach at Middleton Beach, I just look across the boat to the island and just really could imagine her out there and how hard it must have been, the only girl. And she just became, she's got into me, she got into my head, and so I just wanted to find out more about her and her story. And really not much was known about her, even her son, who I'm good friends with the family now, he didn't know much about his mum's life out there. So I really had to, only had the bare bones of the historical facts, and so I really need to flesh her out. A few years ago, they found some old family photos of Faye as an older lady, and just freaks me out. I just think, oh, no, in my mind she's always that young girl out there. So I guess with Rose in The Lamplight, it was a different story again, in that she's a fictitious character, but I read a lot about the women of the town, and I guess she's a girl of the era in that she reflects, the courage and the resilience at that time. And the story starts in 1914. She's a young girl, and her big sisters joined the suffragette movement. And so she just really begins to shyly go and read to these soldiers who are at the hospital. But over the next few years, women at the time, everybody had to just get on with it and pitch in for the greater good, which, strangely, like a bit like now, I think the more we can just get on with it and pitch in for the greater good is really what we all have to do in these challenging times. So history repeats in strange ways.
Yeah. Elaine, many of the men in your book are struck by gold fever. Gold fever is often a very romanticised part of our history. Can you tell us a little about the harsh realities that met those men who went to find their fortunes in the goldfields?
Certainly they, in the Coolgardie area, which Bailey's Reward mine became the town of Coolgardie later. Clara was still there when it was declared a town, but those men who went out there so far out into the desert to find their fortunes, many of them came from Ireland or from the USA or from overseas. The harshness of that climate and that environment just was such a shock to them. And they clumped together on the field, on the new diggings. They would rush out there, pitch their tent somewhere, but then they would find they really needed the not just the company, but often the skills of their compatriots from their country. So you got these little enclaves of Irishmen or men from the States, particularly Montana, which seemed to send a lot of men over here and became almost a suburb of Coolgardie. It was called Montana because that's where all the USA prospectors camped. And they were really living a subsistence life. They had no water. Water cost 2 and 6 pence a gallon. So they there's one funny incident where in the pub, and the pub kept expanding so that they could accommodate more people because the men were desperate. Some of them were, lots of them were dying out there. And the pub was like a sort of haven of everything, a hub of everything where everybody gathered and they could ask advice, they could get some sustenance, some food or drink when they ran out. And yeah, it was just a really hand-to-mouth existence. And Clara, of course, was right in there all the time helping these guys who were starving and in the pub, I started to tell this bit of the story about the water bag. The water was in one of these jugs if you paid for it for 2 and 6 a gallon. So one of those jugs with the bowl underneath, the type they had back then. And some wag had scrawled across the sign that said, water, you have to request some water in the jug. And you have to pay 2 and 6 pence a gallon. And so this guy wrote underneath, wash in champagne, it's cheaper. So a bottle of champagne cost them less than a gallon of water. A bottle of champagne in the pub.
Wow, that tells you a bit about the harshness of life at that time.
Absolutely.
Diane, well, Australia's involvement in world wars is another part of our history that's very glorified, romanticised. What were you trying to do that was different to the books that came before? And was it challenging to tackle an era that's been written and overwritten so many times?
I really didn't think about it that much. I was just following, I think as we mentioned, the writer instincts. And I thought that Phase 3 was a fascinating one and I hope that other people would also be interested in it. So I began researching and writing that in early 2005, and the era wasn't overwritten at all then. There was basically nothing much out there. And it took me 4 years to do that first book, the research and the writing, and all of the information that it just took me hours and hours on microfiche and trying to find anything and interviewing people. All of that information I could now just go up to the National Anzac Centre in Albany, which opened about 2014, I think. I could find all of that information in a few hours, but at the time there wasn't anything really out there, so it just took me really a long time. So I guess I wasn't really trying to tackle an era. However, when the research led to Lighthorse Boy, most of the writing and research was happening 2011, 2012. And there's no doubt that at that point I thought, look, there's going to be this big commemorative event in 2014, so it would be good for me to just get my skates on and keep going with this and make sure that's out before that. So I think even though when Writer's Voice came out in 2013, there were quite a few other books about the animals, like exploring World War One through the animals and horses in particular, and there have been more since. But I think each writer's bringing a different angle. I think there's still more to be said about them, and there's just, I guess everyone brings a different, or brings their own heart and interest to it. So even though it has been written quite a few times, I think there's still a lot more to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I like the following the writer's instinct, this kind of compulsion to write about this thing.
That's right. Sometimes I wonder why am I so interested in wartime, but I think it's like now, these challenging times bring out the best and the worst in people, and that's interesting for a writer, I think.
No, I wanted to know, who allowed this to actually happen when she was one of the, you know, one of two only women to be in this, goldfields town? Was this normal, Elaine? How common was it for girls to be going out into the middle of nowhere and working?
It wasn't common, and Clara was such a strong character, and she was after an adventure. She'd sort of come from Queensland all the way around, boring trip on the steamer, and then she'd done this buckboard buddy trip out to Southern Cross. But in Southern Cross, she was working in the pub that her sister and brother-in-law managed in Southern Cross, but she had a very minor role. And but she was strong and big, and she had always worked. All of her family all pitched in, because they lived on gold fields as well, and they kept moving. As the gold would peter out on one field, they'd move to the next. And Clara knew, well, she saw this gold brought in to Southern Cross, and it fascinated her. She thought it was the most amazing thing she'd ever seen. Even though she'd grown up on gold fields, her father never made a success of being a prospector. He eventually worked in a mine with the two older boys. But, for Clara, this was her father's dream of wealth, and, here it was sitting here right in front of her, and it had been found out there, which was not, at that stage, Coolgardie wasn't an established town. It was just referred to as Bailey's Reward. And so when she knew that the publican from there had come back in to look for someone to help his housekeeper, she's going, me, pick me, and the publican wasn't having anybody else off any offers from anyone else. And so he looked at Clara and he said, how old are you? And she said, I'm 14. And so he said, I think we better go and ask your mother. So he and Clara went off and found her mother, and Mr. Wisdom, which is the name of the publican, he spoke to Clara's mother and said, I think she's a bit young. And Clara's mother said, oh, how dare you infer that my daughter's not capable of, doing this job that you're advertising? And he was really taken aback by that. But Clara was sort of still there in the background saying, I can do it, let me go. So, it wasn't all that unusual for a 14-year-old to be working, but it was unusual for her to go so far out on her own with no other family members.
Yeah, it's definitely quite remarkable, especially since, and we do have that scene in the book when the mother's like, very almost proud, like, of
That's
course
right,
my daughter
yeah.
can do this.
Yes, of course she can. I brought her up to be a strong, independent woman. What are you talking about?
Can I jump in there as well? In that, when I read that scene, Elaine, I really felt that came to life. In that, I think as a writer, if that wasn't based on truth, you wouldn't think to do that.
No,
but it such, to me, it was like, oh wow, that who would have thought that would be the reaction? And so it's interesting when you now say, that's based as so much of your book is on your incredible research, that really comes across as an unexpected thing. It's like, oh, what a strange reaction. And so it has that ring of truth, which is great.
Yes, it is. It is. And I was lucky that in the Battley Library they had, mind you, it took me a long time to find it because they didn't have it catalogued as I would have expected. But the journal that Clara wrote was a big part of my research for that book. Unlike Black Jack Anderson, when there was nothing, essentially, until I got to the Battley Library, with Clara, there was a little bit. And then I knew by then that I had to hone in and find that journal. It was referred to obliquely in Google posts and things, but no, not very much of it. But when I found it, it was such a treasure.
Yeah, I was also fascinated by Clara's book. Her, you actually had many eyewitness accounts for
yes,
what you've written.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Diane, you've also got characters in remote areas, remote islands. Some of them go to war underage. They become nurses as teenagers. So it seems like teenagers and young people were an important part of the war effort. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely. And interesting that Clara just, like, she was so keen to get out there and go, whereas Faye didn't really have a choice. She was stuck on the island. So different, I guess, different situation. But I think in wartime, everybody did play their part, and both Rose and Faye, as girls of the era, characters of the era, they're so much more responsible than, I suppose, they had to be responsible. They were, you know, skinning rabbits, dressing wounds, treating shell shock, and being faced with horrific things. But they didn't have internet or TV as well, so they didn't know the war. There was an innocence about them that even girls who are younger than they are now, like 10-year-olds, know all about war and see the repercussions and study it at school and see visually the effects. Whereas they would have been more innocent in that area, even though they had to be so responsible and practical. And I think one thing that really interested me were how girls were also used in horrible ways, and I guess without really knowing the repercussions of their actions, in that the handing out of the white feathers to me is such an interesting thing. There's so many sides to it. And so I have my Rose character at some stage, she's not handing out feathers, but she's conflicted when there's another girl who is. And that the, I guess when they were handing out those white feathers, having no understanding of what they were forcing, or I guess sparking young men, young boys to go and you know, do their bit, if you like, without knowing what they were sending them to. So, yeah, really.
Can you tell us a bit about that, the handing out of white feathers? So what was that?
So in World War One, and in some other wars as well, but certainly in World War One, if young men of an age where they could be a soldier were not in uniform, then girls would go in Harefield, say, down to the village green, and they had a basket of white feathers, and so they would hand out white feathers to men who weren't in uniform, or they would put them in their letterbox, or they'd send them. And of course, it was so, the men felt ashamed. They were so shamed, even if they had very good reason, if they were supporting a lot of people, or perhaps who knows what they were doing, but the shame, even if they weren't medically fit, the shame of receiving a white feather often caused them to sign up, and often they died. So I wonder for those, you know, those girls, the teenagers really, who are giving out those white feathers, what their feelings were when the men that they had given the white feathers to, some of their, you know, the boys that they were going to school with perhaps, when they died. I wondered what that's interesting again, I think, from a writer's point of view. There's a lot of different sides to that, just that one action. And so in all of the books, we'll say in The Lamplight, for example, so often I came, as part of the research, I'd find things like that, or I wanted to explore things like that, like the suffragette movement or lots of other aspects. And it's like there's little mini stories within, there's the whole, you know, the main story, Rose's journey, But there's also little stories within, but because of the space limitations and including all the archival photos and beautiful illustrations by Brian Simmons, there wasn't space to go into each one. Each one had to be very brief, but I would hope that readers of all ages, young ones but also older ones, it gives them something to ponder, something to think about, something that they might like to find out more about. And there's lots of things in the Lamplight. So, you know, like the Harefield flag is another story, and there's just lots of things in there that I would hope people would go and go to the website, look at some of the links, and find out more about those other aspects.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's something I'd never heard about. You know, we've heard so many different stories about wartime, about the gold fields and the gold rush. One thing that I think is often missing is that history rarely records the contributions of women, let alone children, like Clara and Faye. So I want to know from both of you, is doing historical fiction about women and girls harder due to a lack of source material? Diane, what's been your experience?
Not necessarily, because I think what I do is really I'm gathering the framework, the historical framework, and in both cases I am imagining a character. So for me it wasn't really, because it wasn't like Elaine, where I suppose perhaps a completely different situation where she's having to, you know, needing to research and find those details when history is so often from a male's point of view. In my case, a lot of my female characters had to be largely imagined, and then I put them into the war years as a backdrop to then use those characters to explore things like the suffragette movement and different battles and how life changed for villagers along the way. So one of the things that was really interesting, I thought, was with the suffragette movement in Australia and New Zealand, women had the vote. However, in the UK, they didn't, and the suffragette movement was becoming increasingly violent. But then war broke out and the battle was put on hold for the war years. But ironically, when the men had all gone, the women stepped up to do the jobs, like to deliver the mail and drive the trams and make munitions, which a few months earlier would have been unthinkable. And so they then did those jobs, realised that, of course, they could do them. And so after the war, then, you know, they didn't want to give those back, really. And so there was a big shift. So, coming back to your question, for me, researching a particular woman, I didn't need to. It was more for me researching the backdrop. So it wasn't a problem for me as such.
What about you, Elaine?
Well, it sort of comes back to the story grabs you, and I had thought about writing about the goldfields and thought, no, everybody else has done it already. You know, I've got all these stories written by men, about tall tales and, you know, adventures and everything. And I thought, I can't write about the goldfields because I needed an angle, and a different angle. And at one point it just sort of popped into my head. I thought, oh, well, where are the children in all these stories about men and their adventures? Where are the children? And so I started looking for the children and couldn't find any. The only one I Googled and did trove and all sorts. The only one that was documented enough to make the story was Clara. And that was mainly due to her journal. I didn't know that until much later, but once I discovered her journal, I thought, aha, this is why people, you know, on Wikipedia and Google things and code, this is why they refer to her, because she's the only one who's really documented. The other children are just staying at home. The women didn't go out to the goldfields. It was just the men. And so when the women were staying home, the children were at home. So, yeah, it was sort of Clara launching out there and then writing about her experiences afterwards.
I want to know the story behind these stories and how you did your how you actually came to do your research. You've told us a bit about how you've done the research, but what tips would you both of you have for listeners interested in writing historical fiction? Elaine, what tips would you have?
I think the biggest tip is you can't just believe one source. You find a source of a story and you read that, but it's written by one person, and you really need to corroborate that by finding something that cross-references it, if you like. So you can't always trust the one source. Google is a glaring example, and on Wikipedia and Google searches and things, they may give information, but it either may not be enough or it may be quite conflicting with other sources. So you can't just rely on one source. The other thing is, keep going. But usually if you're hooked on the story, you will keep going anyway.
What about you, Diane? What tips do you have for writers of historical fiction?
Well, I think for me, the books are, because it's over a long time span, like going from the microfiche beginnings, I've learned along the way that having a research trip is really valuable, and also to being open and ready to what you might find. So you've got your idea and you're putting things in place, you've got your plotting ideas and your character ideas, but what you might find is that as part of that process, that you learn a lot and that changes your character. So research trips are always valuable. I went out to Break the Island and went to Lone Pine and Gallipoli. Going to Harefield was really interesting because it's England. It's not somewhere that I know as well, and it was interesting to research how the war experience in a smaller English village was similar, but you know the idea of seeing Zeppelins over London and also how the villagers were so touched by these young men who travelled across the world to help defend them, and so they then felt very protective and wanted to help them. But I guess one example of that being open is there was a photograph of a wallaby at Harefield, which really inspired my story. And finding out more. And in all of the war memorial, the Canberra War Memorial's image collection, it's called Jiminy. Whereas when I researched the Harefield book, it was called Jimmy. And I thought, well, surely there's not two wallabies in one small English village, Jimmy, Jiminy. I thought it's probably the same one. But I wanted to, just in my own interest, I wanted to get it right. So I think really, really following through and doing what it takes as much as you can to get the research as good as it can, because otherwise there'll always be readers afterwards who'll come back and point things out that you've got wrong. So in that case, I went to the War Memorial in Canberra and went down to the records section, went through, requested a box of the Harefield Boomerang, a magazine that the hospital put out, and just went through with white gloves until I thought, well, look, they've got a kangaroo mascot, surely it's going to be mentioned. So I went through until I found details about what happened to that mascot, and it was the little wallaby was referred to as Jimmy. So I know that that's the primary source, so I know that the wallaby was called Jimmy. So I guess it's following two things, following through and doing the research as best you can, but also going on a research trip, but also being open to shifting. So rather than locking in, like Lighthouse Boy was originally just about the journey of the soldiers from Albany across to the Middle East, but wise Kate Sutherland, made a passing comment about me stopping at an interesting time. And at first I didn't want to shift that. I'd done such a lot of work, over 120 pages on that journey, but that then ended up being only the first third of Lighthouse Boy. So her advice was wise, and I sensed that it was wise. So I guess also getting feedback from a trusted editor or a trusted reader, those things are really important, I think.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just have to accept that those months or even years of research you did may even not go into the book.
No, absolutely.
Now, you, Diane, you mentioned going through things with white gloves. Now, I have a good memory of those white gloves because I used to be one of the people who would give people visiting libraries white gloves. I used to work at the State Library where I was in the stacks. I was actually fetching things for people. So I worked in stock and stack where I would go and get, if you were the researcher and you put a request in, I went and got it. And I would
what
often
a fabulous
deliver
job.
Those. I was in my late teens, early 20s. It was one of the best jobs I've ever had. I loved it. And Batty was my ground. Like I knew where if you couldn't find something in Batty, someone would come and get me to get it. Now, so I want to talk about libraries. When you get those white gloves and you go through those old, beautiful things, how did your research manifest in libraries? Diane, can you tell me a bit more about your experience with libraries?
Yes, with Lighthouse Girl, I'm incredibly fortunate to live in an historical town, which was the main setting. So the Albany History Collection at the library, well, it's not located there anymore, they have a beautiful collection of archival photos and lots of lovely old things, and the museum here as well. So I looked at their postcard collections and spent a lot of time going through their records. And in Harefield, at the library there, the History Society, it's not a library, but the History Society, from afar, I was sending emails backwards and forwards with passionate historians at the History Society in Harefield. So I guess I did a little bit at the State Library, but particularly Lighthouse Girl, it was mostly Albany-based. And then Lighthouse Boy was largely searching the Australian War Memorials collection online. But then a few times I did get to go over there and don the white gloves. It was really exciting and looking at the ship records. And you'd start and the day was over. Suddenly the day had gone and I thought, oh, no, I don't have a lot of, don't have a lot of days, and it just went so quickly. It's really exciting. You don't know what you're going to find in there.
What about you, Elaine? What's your experience been researching in libraries?
Well, I haunt the Batty when I'm researching. I haunt the Batty Library. And with Clara in particular, I was puzzled because I kept getting these little mentions of this 14-year-old girl called Clara Saunders. And I sort of think, well, if there's anything more that I can find about her, it must be in the Batty. But when I went to the Batty this time, I was having had many, many successes there. But when I went looking for Clara in the Batty, I couldn't find her journal. I could find letters and things like that they'd pull out for me to that referred to her or that were from much later in her life. I just could not find this journal that had been obliquely referred to, and I thought, it must be here, it must be here. I drove them mad in the reading room at the Batty, nagging them about this girl. And one day, and they were always so helpful and patient to me. And one day, we had all the Clara information up on the screen of the library assistant. And I said, but it has to be a book. It has to be bigger than these letters and reports and things. It were only a couple of pages. Anyway, I saw this name on the screen there, and it was C. Payton. There was this 78-page transcript, and the author, or the only author's name on it, was this C. Payton. And suddenly it hit me like a blinding light because I'd read a lot of about Clara's married life, and she'd married three times. The last husband was John Payton, P-A-T-O-N. And suddenly I thought, I've been staring at this and I've been thinking it's written by someone else. It's written by Clara, I bet. And so they got it out from in the stacks for me. And sure enough, it was Clara's journal that I'd been searching so long for. And I was just so excited. They were ready to throw me out. I think I was dancing around the place.
That's so exciting.
Yes, it is. It is so exciting. And
Elaine, I was so excited when I read that. I don't know if I read it in the notes or on a publicity thing, but when I read exactly what you just said,
yeah.
I was so excited for you. I thought, oh, Sleuth, how wonderful. I can just imagine that moment.
Yeah, it was a magic moment, I can tell you. And so that opened up the whole of her life, and I was able to read her voice. I was able to listen to her voice while I was reading it. You know, her voice came through so strongly that it was hugely helpful and important to the development of her character.
Yeah, I think something that you've also, both of you have touched on is the tremendous amount of time that you both spent doing this. So obviously writers need money. We all need money. But when you're doing historical fiction, doing historical research, you have lead times, you know, it takes so long. You need a bit more money, more than most people. So I'm curious about the support you received with your research and your writing. What kind of funding or support have you received, and how can other writers access these? Elaine, I'd love to start with you.
Well, I'm the worst. I've decided that over the years I am the worst applicant writer for funds, because everyone else seems to get funded by the DCA or whoever, and I very rarely do. Once I was funded for research by the DCA, and once I had one of those flights where I could go to Canberra research, or I don't think it was Canberra that I was looking at then, but a private, I'm not sure how to describe them, but they were an arts and business link-up group, and they offered, well, I applied to them, and they said, oh, sounds like a fantastic idea. So I did have that one research trip that was funded, and I went to France and researched the previous book to see the world. So I'm not a good person to ask, really. Mark Greenwood's good at that.
Well, Diane, what about you? Are you better at filling in funding applications?
Oh, look, the finances page just does my head. It takes me so long. I'm a bit wrong in there, and need help. But I put in for applications, and also, like Elaine, had many rejected. But sometimes you're allowed to then have another go. I mean, you're only allowed so many times. But I then ask for feedback and then try to, usually it's the finance page, but I put it in a second time, and I'm so, so grateful to the West Australian Department of Culture and the Arts, because I've had some funding help for each of the three light books, Lighthouse Girl, Lighthouse Boy and In the Lamplight. And the time, as you, it's so perceptive of you, I guess you realise how long it does take, particularly historical fiction, the research is massive. And Lighthouse Girl took me 4 years all up from idea to publication. Lighthouse Boy and In the Lamplight were 3 years each. So it's a long journey. And if you're working on other things in between drafts and doing other things, like going out to school and things. But it is to receive funding is incredible. So I guess it's that financial support, but it's also the support in other ways. And I know Fremantle Press has been incredibly generous with support letters, which then help you get a grant. They've always been kind with that. But also arranging, once the book's out, then people, first-timers, don't realise how hard it is to keep the book out there. And I know Claire Miller's just amazing at getting these opportunities for us all to go to festival and come up with interesting ideas. All of the light books have been serialised in the West Australian Ed supplement. But also, you know, if you left a few things, she comes up with some great ideas that help keep those books alive, which means that if I then am putting out a second or a third book, say for In the Lamplight, for example, there were readers who, because those other stories were still alive, were interested in reading a third one. So I think there's support financially, but also there's other support from publishers and other writing groups is incredibly valuable. And my advice for writers would be to keep going with those drafts, to get, if they will allow you to ask questions about how to get help with it, take that. But also keeping in the loop, it's really important to keep in the loop with writing WA, for example, has been incredibly helpful in this lockdown time with lots of opportunities. But also join support groups like the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators or the Australian Society of Authors have got details. There are so many websites out there and so many authors at the moment and creative illustrators as well are just putting out so much information. There's just so much information that there's a lot of, by keeping in the loop, I think writers can find out, well, what is available and there are new things coming up all the time or this grant's been exhausted. So keeping in the loop, really, really important.
Yeah, okay. certainly the coronavirus thing has given us more opportunities and the funding out of the Australia Council and that sort of thing. It's unprecedented, really.
There's so many people putting things out that I'm feeling a bit bewildered by the things that are out there.
So keep Googling, hey?
Keep Googling, that's it.
Keep
Googling. Okay, now we're coming to the end of our chat. Before we go, I want to know from you, two veteran writers, how has your writing process changed over the years and how has the publishing industry changed? Elaine?
It's a tricky one. I mean, you obviously change and develop as a writer. The longer you do it, the more, I suppose, not so much the more good at it, but the more you know the pitfalls that you might avoid by being experienced. So it does change slowly. The publishing industry, I think, has changed a lot more and a lot faster in the last few years. And when I first was published by Penguin, there was always time. You sat with the editor and they were patient. And Julie Watts, who was the publisher at the time at Penguin Children's section, she used to say to both my editor and me, don't get it out there, get it right. So she was always willing to have another go at it or have do another draft. Nowadays, apart from Premier Press, and they are fantastic, but a lot of the other publishers just don't have that time anymore. Penguin's disappeared under the Random House banner and they're all for getting it out there quickly and not going back over it. So, yeah, I think one has changed and one hasn't much.
I think that's a good thing for, you know, emerging writers to keep in mind. I've been talking to some other writers about their experiences of working with editors and publishers, and I felt like my experience of, you know, Fremantle Press wanting to get it right, not necessarily to push it out, has been
one of the very few now.
Yeah, it's not always an experience shared. So I hope other writers listen to that and go, no, like I'll put my foot down if they're pushing me. Like I have to get it right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have to stand up to them now and say, well, you know, it'll need more time. I'm not prepared to let it go like this. So I'm going to go back over it. And if that doesn't sit well with them, then too bad. I have to pull it.
Diane, what about you? How has your writing process changed and how have you found the publishing industry changed?
I think like Elaine, my process, obviously over time you streamline and I try to streamline my process a little bit, like Kate Sutherland's words echo. Overarching plot, Diane, overarching plot. I try to think about the overarching plot because that's important. But I also, so I don't waste too much time going off on tangents that may not even be in the book. So I do try to streamline a bit, but I try, right? I don't know what I do, but anyway, I try. But I think as far as how it's changing at the moment, I just think there's this push and it sort of starts above the publishers, really, about having things have to be commercial enough. And I think when Elaine and I both started, there was more space, and I don't think this has changed at Fremantle Press, but I think the broader picture, that's one of the most amazing things. I think Fremantle Press is a boutique, smaller publisher. But there is, if it's not commercial enough, the marketing and publicity departments seem to have an awful lot of power, and the beautiful ideas and some of the more gentle stories that may not have massive print runs, but that are very valuable stories, may not be seeing the light of day these days. You know, because the bottom lines have to be met. That is something that I feel has shifted in the last 5 years. But then again, I suppose some other little boutique niche publishers have popped up. But that is one change. But I think also we have a lot of more amazing creative West Australian authors and illustrators, which is brilliant and wonderful. They're explaining such their own unique gifts. It is then more competitive, though. When I first started, there was only a handful. When Goody started in Western Australia, there was only about 10 of us, whereas now there's 200 of them. So there's more competition, clearly. Then again, you know, that just means you've got to lift your game. So, you know, having said that, there is only a limited pool of money. And if a publisher can, say, only do 10 kids' books a year, then there are already, say, I know Elaine, there's so many amazing West Australian creatives. There's way more than just 10 who do have, like Elaine and I have quite a few books out there. But we can't all be published. If there's 20 of us and there's only 10 spots, then you can't all get published that year. So that's tricky. That I've noticed is a change. But I guess, you know, what can you do? We're all encourage people to buy more Australian books. Perhaps that's the answer. I don't know. I don't know.
I think that's a good thing to end it on. Like, encourage our listeners, buy more Australian books, because then we'll get more publishers just getting more money to publish more Australian books.
Well said.
All right. Now, Elaine, Diane, thank you so much for joining us. Listeners, Elaine's new book, Goldfields Girl, is out now, and Diane's Light series is still available from fremantlepress.com.au and local bookstores offering delivery. Elaine, Diane, thank you so much for this. If you enjoyed our chat today, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. My name's Rebecca Hickey, and I've been your host today. In 2019, I won the Fogarty Literary Award, and my own novel blending history and fiction, The History of Mischief, will be out in September. Join me next time for more tips and tricks from the experts of the writing world.